The program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hi, this is Dick Shanley, and for the next hour, I will be reading from Sunday's November 30th issue of the New York Times opinion section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This article is written by Maureen Dowd. Time to let Kevin do the carving. My researcher, Andrew Chomsky, suggested gummies as a Thanksgiving side dish. He knows the annual toast of President Trump at the family Thanksgiving, set by my teeth on edge. Maybe edibles will lead to a lighter vibe, but I'm still recovering from my wild ride 11 years ago when pot was legalized and had a night of extreme paranoia after nibbling off the end of a THC-infused candy bar. So this year I swallowed the toast, as I usually do, with a gulp of the Trump champagne my brother served. Speaking of Kevin, here is his annual letter from the right, but not always correct side. Editorial comment. I remember last year Thanksgiving, and it's cute that they have different viewpoints. Red lights are blinking for both parties. New York voters chose Zohran Mamdani, a socialist Elmer Gantry with little experience, to be mayor of the world's most important city. President Trump held a chummy Oval Office meeting with him and made it look as if the president was ready to trade jobs. Mamdani's election was propelled by younger voters, enthralled by his promises of free things. From a rent-free freeze to free buses to government-run grocery stores to a $30-an-hour minimum wage, he made the case for a socialist society. On November 21, a resolution was brought to the House floor condemning socialism. 98 Democrats voted against it. Cracks are showing in the president's ironclad hold on the Republican Party. Congress all but forced him to agree to release the Epstein files. But after he castigated his most slavish supporter, Marjorie Taylor Greene, as a traitor for pushing the release, Greene announced she would resign her House seat, later denouncing the wicked snow globe of Washington, D.C. This is a loss. Green was a loyalist. She gazed at Trump and with Nancy Reagan level of adoration. Trump is oblivious to the fact that when you threaten someone to the point that she considers herself a battered wife, sometimes it cannot be fixed. Trump's telling a Bloomberg News reporter, quiet, quiet, piggy, and calling a Times reporter ugly inside and out was beneath contempt. Our mother always said, there's never an excuse for bad manners. Six congressional Democrats released a shameful video without giving any context, encouraging service members to disobey illegal orders, thereby threatening the chain of command. But instead of shaming them, Trump posted on Truth Social that was seditious behavior, punishable by death, causing the oily Senator Chris Murphy to warn that the life of every Democratic congressperson was in jeopardy. Congress won governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia, but the Virginia race was muddled by unearthed 2022 texts sent by their candidate for attorney generals, Jay Jones, musing about killing then-Speaker of the Virginia House and watching the man's two young children die in his mother's arms. Abigail Spanberg, the Democrat who was elected governor, refused to ask Jones to drop out of the race. Jones was elected anyway. showing how Virginia feel about decency. It had been a bad year for Democrats after regaining office. Trump proceeded at breakneck speed to undo much of the damage the Biden administration had wrought, immediately closing the border and deporting criminals. The Democrats resisted, but their leaders kept getting trapped on the wrong side of the argument. Boys in girls' sports and locker rooms, LGPD, teaching in lower grades with no opt-out and no parental input on gender ID. Chuck Schumer, one of the least popular Democrats, shut down the government to mollify his party in exchange he got nothing. Nancy Pelosi announced her retirement, perhaps to day trade. One of the most disgusting spectacles right now is the demonization of ICE agents by elected officials in major cities. They have put law enforcement officers in harm's way. As the son of a police officer, I am repulsed to hear lightweights like Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois paint ICE agents as, in Pritzker's words, jackbooted thugs and encourage interference with officers. If Trump gets overconfident in the face of such idiocy, here's some advice. Remind ICE that we are trying to deport criminals with violent police workers, not landscapers. Do not let Stephen Miller convince you that the deportation must rise and do a better job of communicating what you are doing. And do not underestimate the powers of grocery receipts. Voters see them three times a week. Trump looks out of touch when he tells voters the 401k will show how great the economy is. Many don't have a 401k. Lower tariffs on food items. Do not lose voters over a bag of potato chips. Surveys have shown the country might like a third political party. It could be the Democratic Socialists, a slow-growing cancer for Democrats. If Republicans can't address affordability better, Democratic Socialists will poach Republican voters too. Socialism has never worked anywhere in the world. Our country has built on capitalism, and that has served us well for almost 250 years. Democrats can only hope that Zoran Mamdani is a huge flop on Broadway. Next article is written by David Brooks. David Brooks is one of my favorites. My love for America is unconditional. Americans used to be nearly universally proud of their country in January 2001. 90% of Republicans and 87% of Democrats say we're extremely very proud to be American. Now the situation has changed. Today, 92% of Republicans still say they are very proud to be Americans, but only 36% of Democrats say that according to a recent Gallup survey. That's from 87% to 36%. Members of the two parties have different sorts of pride in their country. Republicans' pride is unconditional. Democrats like Barack Obama and Joe Biden can get elected to the presidency and an almost no effect on the pride Americans feel for America. Democratic pride is more conditional. It dropped a bit during George Bush's first term, then began to gradually decline during the Great Awakening around 2014 and really collapsed during each of President Trump's two terms. The trend is especially strong among the young. More Gen Z Democrats say they feel little or no pride of being an American. They say they feel very proud. I don't side much with the party of MAGA these days, but my patriotism is more like the Republican kind, unconditional. My love of the country this Thanksgiving season is not based on what this or that politician does, but what America has always been. Let me put it this way. Through most of Western history, leading thinkers regarded ambition as unmitigated sin. For much of civilization, people have lived in societies with feudal pecking orders. Everybody had the station we were born into and would die in. Peasant, merchant, aristocrat. To be ambitious was to try to rise above your station and thus disturb the whole system. Ambition's reputation in Europe didn't begin to shift until the discovery of the New World. Suddenly, there were new continents to explore. It wasn't a zero-sum world anymore. From the start, America aroused great dreamers, great energies, great ambitions. J. Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur, a Frenchman, came to America to fight in the French and Indian War in the mid-18th century, and then settled on a farm on the Hudson River from New York. A European then, when he first arrived, seems limited to his intentions, he wrote. But he very suddenly alters his scale. 200 miles formerly appeared a very great distance, is now but a trifle. He no sooner breathes our air than he forms schemes and embarks on designs he never will have thought of in his own country. That's what I love when I love America, its ability to arouse ambition, energy, and activity. But here's the catch. When you love America for its raw energy, you're loving it for a force that also produces crassness, materialism, and from time to time, immaturity. That is to say, the same cultural winds that propel the noble aspirations of an Abraham Lincoln also propel the gaudy display of Donald Trump and the occasionally recklessness of Elon Musk. America's most faithful lovers have always seen that America's spiritual greatness entwined with its embarrassing materialism. In his 1871 book, Democratic Vistas, Walt Whitman acknowledged America's almost maniacal appetite for wealth. He lamented, never was there perhaps more hollowness at heart than at present. Yet America's striving ethos nonetheless serves as a training school for making grand young men. It's life gymnasium that produces freedom athletes. Whitman never stopped celebrating the nobility of regular working people. Popular democracy, whatever its faults and dangers, practically justifies itself beyond the proudest claims and wildest hopes of enthusiasts. Lincoln was regarded by Whitman and by so many of the rest of us as the embodiment of the American creed. His ambition, his law partner, William Henry Hearn, once said, was an engine that knew no rest. I hold the value of life is to improve one's condition. Lincoln himself declared it was precisely this sense of possibility that Franklin Roosevelt loved about America, its capacity to encourage that his cousin Theodore called the strenuous life happiness. FDR argued, lies not in the mere possession of money, it lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of created effort. These days it can seem that most Americans have lost faith in all of that. A recent Wall Street Journal poll found that only 31% of Americans believe in the American dream. The idea that you can get ahead by working hard. Nearly half of Americans say they used to believe in it, but no longer do, while 23% say they never did. Maybe that state of demoralization explains why Americans watch passively as China leapfrogs from us in one scientific and technological field after another. More papers in the elite scientific journals are now written by Chinese scholars than by American ones. Why are we not doing everything we can do to preserve our status as a nation of futurity? And yet, I don't quite believe that the American spirit has been as thoroughly trampled as it sometimes appears. Yes, the country is in a low mood, but a nation climb DNA is not something that gets rewritten in a decade. Look at history. American lost faith in themselves in the 1970s and the failures of the Great Society, the retreat from Vietnam, the corruption of Watergate, the impotent presidency of Jimmy Carter, the rising crime and divorce rates, the awful stagflation, the decay of our largest cities. But was the loss of faith permanent? No. Americans elected Ronald Reagan president in 1980. They elected optimism, patriotism, and hope. They're still deep inside the nation's core, a little engine that knows no rest. Editorial comment. Brooks is an excellent, excellent writer. Comedy and horror of becoming my parents' keepers. The first sign of trouble arrived by text. On December 17th at 2:33 p.m., my younger sister Melissa pinged me from Houston to say that her 78-year-old father had veered off course while driving himself to a medical appointment. He has missed his exit, she wrote. I don't want to call him and tell him because he will be pissed that I am tracking him. What do we do? Honestly, just let him run, I wrote back from my home in Washington. This wasn't the first time Dad had gone rogue while driving. Just the day before, he had cruised in almost aimless circles around unfamiliar neighborhoods for over an hour, dismissing worried calls from her mom, but this time he was missing lab appointments related to his bladder cancer. The family knew that Dad was chafing under the restrictions that went with this chemotherapy. No crowds, no gardening, no letting the dog lick his face. But we also knew that drugs would cause a cognitive issue. Dad's oncologist had warned us to be on the alert for odd behavior. Like an overprotective mom, my sister had started tracking his phone, mostly without his knowledge. My dad got crabby when he thought anyone was treating him like an invalid. Maybe he is just trying to explore every major Houston freeway this week, joked Melissa, whom we all called Mel. Everyone needs a hobby, I suggested. Judge if you must. Dark humor is my family coping mechanism of choice. The hospital called her mom to ask why my dad hadn't shown up. Alerting her to the situation, mom called Dad, who claimed to be stuck in traffic. True only if stuck in traffic meant driving in circles. As hour two of our vigil approached, I suggested my sister take a break. I can't, she said. It's like the third season of Strange Things. I don't want to watch, but I couldn't look away. I have to know what's happening. Dad eventually drifted home after burning up 40 miles over the course of nearly 2 hours and missing two appointments. He tried to shrug off the whole episode, but something was clearly off. Mel and I agreed that I should at least talk with him about hitting the pause button on driving. Spoiler, that did not go well. We had no idea what was coming. Caring for an aged loved one is a journey, and not like a low-key pleasure trip with a clear itinerary you can plan and pack for. The road is constantly dipping and turning to accommodate the vagaries of the aging. I, for instance, have lost count of how many bones my mom has broken in recent years. Rolling through his 70s, my dad, Bill, a Navy veteran, retired nuclear energy executive, was a force of nature, active, socially independent until he wasn't. In August 2024, he was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And just like that, my sister and I were scrambling to address his proliferating health needs, as well as to assume his role supporting our medically fragile mom, Brenda. Another editorial comment, the dad was in trouble at 78, fortunately. I was exceedingly fortunate. I was still playing tennis at age 78. The latter was what worried Dad. Facing months of chemotherapy followed by surgery, he never expressed anxiety about his prognosis. He did share his fear of being unable to take care of Mom. I assured him that Mel and I could handle whatever lay ahead. You can see where this is going faster than you can say chemo brain. My family's caregiving experience spiraled into a chaotic spectacle that was part harrowing medical drama, part sitcom. Even early on, there were 2 a.m. phone calls, mangled medical equipment, emergency room visits, dizzying medication scheduling, epic clashes over how much meddling Dad would stomach from his 2 daughters. "You are your mother's child," he growls whenever. He felt he was being bossy, that I was being bossy, which to be fair, I often was. Our chat about his relinquishing the car keys featured an impressive amount of profanity on both sides. It was, I think, the only time I ever raised my voice to my father. And all this was before my mom fell and shattered her leg during one of Dad's hospital stays. This landed her at a different hospital across town awaiting surgery as a freak snowstorm was bearing down on Houston. But even our most frenzied moments, as when Mel and I were pinballing between hospitals trying to keep one parent from freaking out about the other, we knew we had an easy life compared with many other families. We had both the financial resources and the support system of family and friends to smooth out big bumps. We had each other. Never have I been so grateful not to be an only child. Plus, my parents had taken steps to ease the transition to their golden years. They had signed advance directives and moved into a senior living community that offered continuing care. They had, God love them, covered as many bases as they could. The same cannot be said of American writ large. In recent years, I have become borderline obsessed with the graying of the nation and the challenge for which our society is not prepared. The numbers are ominous. Each day, more than 10,000 baby boomers turn 65. Between 2010 and 2020, the population of seniors grew about 5 times as fast as the overall population. This is sending the demand for medical care, long-term care, safe housing, and other resources skyrocketing along with the cost. On the front lines of this transformation and non-professional family caregivers, an estimated 50 million people in the U.S. are providing informal care for an adult, the overwhelming majority looking someone after 65 or older. A small percentage of family caregivers receive payment for their work, but the vast do not. The need crosses nearly all democratic lines for age, race, geography, politics, religion. In our fragmented society, it is close to a universal concern as you can find. Beyond the numbers of the politics, while caring for loved ones is a deeply personal charge, the weight of that responsibility is influenced by public policy in areas ranging from taxes to labor law to entitlement spending. In his 2024 campaign, Trump promised a tax credit for family caregivers. They add so much to our country and are never spoken of, ever. But they're going to be spoken of, he vowed during a rally at Madison Square Garden the week before Election Day. Back in office, however, Mr. Trump promptly abandoned the idea. It was not among the raft of tax cuts. In his domestic icy bill. Worse still, he has taken steps likely to make family caregiver burdens far heavier. Two major moves stand out. One is the slashing of Medicaid. The other is the broad-based assault on immigration. Together, those actions risk upending a caregiver ecosystem already under strain, throwing millions of families into crises. The week after my father's joyriding, things took a dark turn. On Christmas Day, Dad became convinced, wrongly, that the neophestin tube placed to drain his right kidney had malfunctioned. So like any good ex-engineer, he fixed it. That is, he mangled it so that it was in fact not draining properly, then hid his handiwork from the rest of the family until close to midnight. It took much cajoling by my brother-in-law, Jason, to get Dad to the ER the next morning. Once they were there, the tube became the least of our worries. My father's hemoglobin was dangerously low. The doctor pressed to admit him. Dad was more interested in hectoring every medical professional he saw about his neophthalmectomy. I don't know how to pronounce that. It's neprostomy, nephrostomy. Drain needed a filtration system to prevent backflow. This was, to put it gently, crazy talk, and further convinced everyone he should be admitted as soon as possible. Mel promptly named the family text chain Backflow. Most people get the caregivers is stressful, but no one warns you how farcical it can be. When your grandma refuses to wear her hearing aid, then hollers unflattering commentary about everyone she passes. When your dad keeps trying to bribe the orderlies at the cancer to wheel him outside for a smoke break. When your mom becomes convinced that your husband and your best friends are having an affair and are plotting to steal all her furniture. True stories. These are the moments that don't make it into the family's annual holiday letter. An editorial comment. My sister-in-law is going through some of this, and I can understand the frustration of the writer. Caring for seniors while in love can nonetheless be grinding. It is often compared to parenting, but the emotional and cultural space it occupies is very different. With a frail parent, there is no sense of guiding someone toward a bright future. Quite an opposite. There is no senior equivalent of mummy time playgroups, much less an ocean of lighthearted books, movies, and social media posts chronicling the experience. A diaper disaster involving your toddler makes a great party story. One involving your mom? Not so much. Feelings of isolation and loneliness are common among family caregivers. Nearly one in four reports feeling alone, according to a report. Many talk about feeling invisible, said Marjorie Ullman, who has conducted focus groups for ARP. Many caregivers don't talk a lot about their experience, she said, while many non-caregivers dismiss the work that goes into it until they have to do it. Ms. Omero helps run political focus groups for Time's Opinion. I see this all the time. Those not in the caregiving trenches often don't want to think about the issue, period. Much less chat about it. I mean, who wants to dwell on frailty and death? Among those in the thick of it, many need a nudge to open up. as though broaching the subject themselves would be bad, but there their stories pour out. Surveys and other research spotlight the toll this duty can take. 64% of family caregivers experience high emotional stress and 45% suffer physical strain. Between 40% and 70% show clinically significant symptoms of depression. Caregivers report chronic conditions, including heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and arthritis, is almost twice the rate of non-caregivers, 45% versus 24%. Women are particularly hard hit, reporting higher levels of stress than men. The more involved the caregiver, the greater the strain. More than half of family caregivers handle medical or nursing tasks, in addition to looking with the activities of daily living. Looking after someone with dementia can be extra rough. Loved ones' confusion, fear, and often resentment and anger about what is happening to making terror of them all the more complicated, and all too often, a physical issue will contribute to cognitive troubles or vice versa, resulting in a snarl of mutually reinforcing problems. Even the most devoted family givers may occasionally need outside help, if only a few hours of respite care a week. When that happens, many wind up relying on America's newcomers. Foreign-born workers are the lifeblood of paid caregiving in the U.S. More than 820,000 immigrants provide long-term care service at the direct care workforce. Overrepresented in their fields, foreign-born workers are around 28% of personal care workers and 40% of home health aides. High demand for such workers is already causing shortage in home-based and institution care alike. The Bureau of Labor Statistics project that the demand for care aides will rise 17%. As Mr. Trump throttles the flow of immigrants to the U.S., families are likely to have more and more difficulty finding help. Already, the cancellation of the temporary protected status of hundreds of thousands is causing upheaval. We're seeing a jarring sudden loss of workers, of people who are being sent back to their home country, said Katie Smith, the head of Lending Age, an association of community-based organizations that provide services for seniors. In addition to creating gaps in staffing, the relationship that they've built with the residents and clients they're serving are just broken. Further disruptions loom. For instance, the administration put new barriers on a type of visa that brought in a lot of nurses from the Philippines. Facing access barriers and a hostile climate in the U.S., those nurses are likely to head far more welcoming countries such as Canada, Germany, and Australia. The more restrictive we are, the more it's going to hurt us in the long run. In late January 25, my dad was released from the hospital, frailer and more disoriented than ever. His oncologist suspected he was suffering from hospital delirium, compounded by a scorching urinary tract infection. Worse, Dad was coming home to an empty apartment. My mom, after surgery to repair her leg, been transferred to the post-acute care center in their community. But even absent a fall, she could not have looked after Dad. He was now a serious fall risk who needed eyes on him around the clock. Until he rallied, the situation was more than the family could handle. Mel and I arranged for coverage by a parade of home health aides from Houston-based agency called Family Tree. Dad was less than thrilled. He disliked being fussed over and periodically ordered the aides to leave him alone or even leave altogether. Plus, he missed my mom. His agitated, often salty calls to family members surged. We began comparing notes each evening to see who had received the most. My brother-in-law always one. Dad would ring Jason 2 dozen or more times a day. The family tree aides were endlessly patient. Mostly women hailing from a variety of countries, they would beg, boss, and jolly my dad into getting up and dressed and moving through the day, and dissuade him from going out for a walk at 2 a.m. Dad's favorite aide was the lone man in the bunch, Shabani Ibrahim, who had come to the States from Tunisia in 2009. In addition, working with Family Tree, Shabani works with individuals with intellectual and development disabilities at a group home. He told me how much he loves to help others who need assistance and care. Caregiving professionals observe that foreign-born workers in particular tend to see looking after seniors as desirable, meaningful work. Many come from cultures that revere their relatives, noted Daniel Gottschalk, the chief executive of Family, which relies heavily on foreign-born workers. For anxious families seeking help with mom or dad, this is tremendous comfort, but it's a benefit that Mr. Trump anti-immigration is undermining. When you lose the people who think that this is a great job, it just makes it much tougher. And what you're left with are the people who think that this is just a job, Mr. Gottschalk said. Then it's transactional, and you lose all that soft touch. The soft touch provided invaluable and incalculable reassuring during my father's illness. Shabani could persuade Dad to eat when no one else could. He rubbed cream into Dad's paper dry skin to prevent infection. He made Dad laugh, and he did not bat an eye. My father increasingly mistook him for an old co-worker, family member, which was lucky because it turned out Dad wasn't suffering from short-term delirium. He had Alzheimer's, diagnosed in February, when the oncologist sent him for a neurological assessment to determine when chemo could resume. Once again, the road shifted beneath us. At this point, we should address the 800-pound caregiving gorilla in the room, money. As challenging as caregiving can be for anyone, families with limited resources face next-level stress. Even for families not employing professional aides, the costs quickly pile up. Family caregivers spend on average over a quarter of their annual income on caregiving, factoring in housing and medical. On top of such direct expense, they have the cost of taking time away from their paying jobs to handle caregiving duties like running errands, taking loved ones to doctors, and so on. With my mother in a rehab facility and Dad receiving 24/7 care, the bills started rolling in, and they stung. Mom's expenses were largely covered by Medicare until she stayed beyond what the program allowed. The cost of Dad's aid was around $3,500 a week, was out of pocket from the get-go, since neither Medicare nor private health insurance typically covers most long-term care costs. My dad had saved enough money to ensure that the cost of his and mom's care would not fall for their children. Many are not so fortunate. For them, the bulk of such costs falls to Medicaid, which by far the nation's largest payer for long-term care. The program covers 60% of the $415 billion spent annually on such care. In many cases, even seniors who start out with a nest egg need to do what is called Medicaid spend down of their assets or income to qualify for the program. That is, they need to make themselves poor to get their long-term care covered. Nearly two-thirds of America's nursing home residents have Medicaid as their primary provider of coverage, and roughly 1 in 5 assisted living relies on it to pay for daily service. It also helps pay for the goods and service that make it possible for many seniors to age at home, from wheelchair ramps to shower grab bars to adult papers. I say helps pay because depending on where you live, Medicaid may cover only part of your costs. And again, demand often outstrips supply. As of 167,000 seniors with physical disabilities were waiting for home and community-based care. The total number of people waiting for home care, including those with intellectual disability, was over 700,000. In a 2023 survey, 49 states and District of Columbia reported a shortage of workers providing home care in community. Florida did not respond. Mr. Trump's domestic policy law could make things so much worse. The law is projected to reduce federal Medicaid funding by over $900 billion over the next decade. As these reductions start to bite, states will need to make tough decisions about what and whom to stop covering. The idea that caregiving access will not take a hit seems either naive or intentionally obtuse, especially for seniors hoping to age at home. What we know from history, and when cuts are made by states, they hit home and community-based services, said Mrs. Sloan. Unlike nursing home coverage, she said, home-based care and service are not a mandatory benefit under federal Medicaid laws. Worse, many family caregivers themselves are in Medicaid and will be subject to the new work requirements put in by Mr. Trump's domestic policy. Caregivers looking after young children or loved ones with disabilities are exempt, but those looking after seniors were not granted a specific exemption. As the doctors explained, my father likely had been masking symptoms of Alzheimer's for years. When the cancer and chemo and attendant infections overlooked the system, the dementia was unmasked and progressed with breathtaking speed. Rampaging Alzheimer's meant my dad was no longer a good candidate for surgery or additional chemotherapy. More personally, Alzheimer's ran in his family, and I had long been his greatest fear. Mel and I knew he would not want to endure debilitating treatments to keep his body functioning while his brain betrayed him. We knew it, but we still had to break his diagnosis to him and ask what he wanted to do next. Long ago, my sister and I adopted a rough division of labor when dealing with our parents. Since she lives near them and handles a daily challenge, I get called in to take the lead on hard talks. My parents basically knew, don't make me fly down there, and have been my joking threat for years whenever Mel or I feared they weren't taking care of themselves. Telling your dad his worst fear has come to pass is a different level of hard. Mel and I went to see him on a Sunday morning in mid-February. Mornings were as clear as time. He was tucked into his favorite chair and moved to a footstool over to sit close. When I told him the dementia diagnosis, Mel and I agreed that avoiding the term Alzheimer was best. He flinched and uttered a quiet, oh, or maybe it was okay. He didn't say much for the rest of the conversation, but when it came to his wishes going forward, there were no surprises. He wanted comfort care, nothing more. A few weeks later, an infection prompted us to start him in hospice care. By then he had come unmoored in time and would tell visitors he was playing poker with his brothers, both deceased. The last person he constantly recognized was my mom. He died on April 23. Mom has insisted to live in their apartment by herself with frequent check-ins from Mel and liberal use of grocery delivery service, We have all committed to a flexible one-day-at-a-time approach to the arrangement. My family's caregiving experience with my dad was intense but relatively brief, a matter of months rather than years. I emerged even more concerned about the nation's caregiving crisis, the shortages, the expense, the shaky support system, the lack of thoughtful attention, much less urgency from policymakers. America's aging fast. We need leaders who understand the scope of the challenge and take it seriously. Despite his campaign, happy talk about vaulting family caregivers. Mr. Trump clearly does not. He has given them not so much as a helping hand as a punch in the face, plowing ahead with his policy moves that threaten existing support systems. He owes his voters, all voters, better. While Mr. Trump may not have to worry about who will take care of him and his family as age takes its toll, few of us have that luxury. Time and chance eventually come for all of us, and most families will wind up needing at least a little help navigating the journey. An editorial comment, forget political beliefs. That's unconscionable what Trump has done to cut funding for these types of things. And I can tell by experience, my dad had dementia, but fortunately he was able to put him in a home and taken good care of. And just one other editorial comment. These folks were getting in trouble at 78. And after I read this, I'm most fortunate. I'm 91, had none of these problems. No, a MAGA icon hasn't seen the light. Do you really have to hand it to Marjorie Taylor Greene? The country has come to know the representative from Georgia as a political pit bull who's willing to sink her teeth into the sundry MAGA conspiracy theories that have helped President Trump take over the Republican Party and the country as a whole. But in recent weeks, she's undergone something of rehabilitation, blaming Republicans for a government shutdown and advocating the release of the Epstein files, and bucked her party's leadership in the process. Some people are quick to give her credit, arguing that her absolute face on Trump is a sign that she's truly seen the light, awakening from his Trumpian fugue state. They're missing the point. We aren't watching a political renaissance or a feel-good story about deprogramming the MAGA faithful. We're watching a middle-aged career woman time the market on her political and professional ambition. She has recognized, perhaps rightly, that there's no place for women like her in Trump's halls of power. So she's building herself an escape route. This month, Greene announced that she will be leaving Congress in January. She is not going quietly. A statement justifying her decision is 4 pages long. Her call out of politicians from both sides of the aisle as a weak, cowardly, and exploitative political industrial complex has a nice ring to it. But it's all downhill from here. She doubles down on some of the most vile, unhinged dog whistles and conspiracy theories in American politics. She blames illegal labor for American economic woes, defends her anti-abortion record, and even works in a dig against COVID-19 vaccines. It's a rant chock full of the same conspiracy-minded unpopular populism that Green has been about her entire political career. Perhaps that's because she was a true believer in the incoherent ideology that propelled Trump back to power, or because she, like so many other women, looked at Trump and saw an opportunity for her own self-interest. As surprising it may seem, Trump blew into political power by charming women. He does not cut an attractive figure. His social manners are boorish, if they are present at all. He puts ketchup on his well-done steak. He is weird with his own daughter and even weirder around other people's daughters. He is funny only if you are kind of mean or a total suck-up. Some women find that revolting. But for the women on the right, women with ambition, Trump's disregard for decorum looked like a professional opportunity. Sure, he might joke about sexually assaulting women, but a rule breaker might break some rules for you. If you feel unemployed, if you feel underemployed, underapproached, underappreciated, and undercapitalized, you don't have a lot to lose by betting on the crude guy with the bad jokes. Huh. That's how I think the women who built the Trump political brand. Ideology did not matter to them in the end, because what they did matter was Trump gave them a way to shine. Some of the most visible Trump groupies are members of government. Lauren Boebert, Nancy Mace, Elise Stefanik, Kristi Noem, and of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene. These women brought a certain amount of chutzpah to Trump's brand, adding their feminine touch to his masculine politics of disruptive grit and sexism so that it looked like scamminess and more like populism. In exchange, they rode Trump's ideological coattails to power. This kind of professional overture where women rely on power men for their own professional status can be heady. It's not hard to imagine the one time South Dakota Snow Queen Nem struggling with professional respect, or the GED holder Boebert having a few career options. And for many of them, betting on Trump did pay off. They did not just win elections to gain political appointments, they also became stars. But history can tell you what happens when a king graces a woman with a new powers. When the king tires of her, her reign is over. Viewing Green's newfound political trajectory as bravery assumes that she had something to risk in standing up to Trump. But it is not just as likely that, like millions of women before, Green's status with the king had already been degraded. Trump once described Green's frequent phone calls with great affection. This month, he described them as a nuisance and she as a lunatic. It's a classic breakup drama. It's kind of a shame that Green doesn't seem to have found any value in feminism over her public career, because what she's currently shaping of political fortunes can't be explained rather than simply by feminism 101. Trump's White House is so circus-like, it's easy to forget that it's also a workplace. And women of a certain age know what it means to get older at work. Trump's own admission shows the two roads available. Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, is experienced, credentialed, and seems to be faring just fine in Trump's sexist universe. She also is not counting public attention or trying to build public brand as a political influence. If you don't have her gravitas, your ambition relies on favor. That's where it gets sticky. The Trump ethos rewards precarious, aspirational younger women. Trump governs much like he ran his beauty pageants. Women decorate his atmosphere. They must not challenge him for leadership of it. It wasn't lost on me yet the same month Green announced her retirement and her president dismissed her as a lunatic. Zoran Mamdani, the next mayor of New York City, visited the West Wing. Whereas Green had been restrained, even in her disagreement with Trump, Mamdani is a self-described democratic socialist who has called out the president's fascist tactics. Yet Trump showered Mamdani with praise. He glowed up at him beautifully, looking at the world like a young girl in a Renaissance painting. When the news media pressed Mamdani on his past comments and heckled him about taking in an airplane to Washington instead of a greener option, Trump stepped in to defend him, vociferously even. Yes, there was a lot of hero worship at play. Mamdani is the coolest boy in the only school Trump has ever cared about, New York City. But Mamdani is also a man. The man Green was relying on for a political favor, fawned over a socialist before he would protect his loyal female surrogate. Women helped make Trump. Trump never intended to repay the favor. Some women will figure that out sooner than others. At the end of the day, fantasies of Green's political evolution are overblown. Her own words show that she has no remorse for the immense damage she has done to this nation, to its discourse, to its political legitimacy. Yes, she offered a mealy-mouthed apology for her role in her toxic politics. But on the whole, she is, like many conservative women, a beneficiary of the very feminism that she reviles. She's long thought that being a tough girl rumbling alongside the boys will earn her loyalty when all it ever does is earn women the right then throws on the sword of the men who never deserved their sacrifices. To her credit, Green is a survivor. She took a hard look at her political fortunes and appears to be betting on herself. At some reporting indicates others in the House are also looking to retire. Or she may have mistimed the market on the Trump's political fortunes. Either way, she took the only chance she really had available to her. There is not a real place for women in Trumpism, in MAGA, or in the mainstream Republican Party, as long as they are one and the same. But Green's trajectory is a lesson fit for a fairy tale. If you want to control your own destiny, it's better to be a wicked witch than a princess. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from Sunday, November 30th, issue of the New York Times opinion section. We read from the New York Times review section every Sunday at 2 p.m. Your reader's been Dick Shanley, and thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, followed at 4 by a rebroadcast of this morning's Buffalo News. Please stay for these readings and more throughout the day, and feel free to contact us with your comments, suggestions, with any questions you may have. program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,